Welcome to Indie Film Weekly, a No Film School podcast. I'm Liz Nord, editor-in-chief of No Film School.
And I'm Ryan Koo, founder of No Film School.
It's April 14th, 2016. On this week's show, we'll talk about what's ahead at the big industry event starting this week, Tribeca and NAB, what we learned from the largest analysis of film dialogue ever, and as always, more news, gear, grant and opportunity deadlines in this week's film releases.
So we are coming to you, as usual, from downtown Brooklyn, New York. We're here to catch you up on the things you might have missed while you were making films. And you'll notice that we are coming to you on a new day, Thursday. Indie Film Weekly is designed to be a recap of the week, as well as get you into what's coming out this weekend. So we felt like Thursday made more sense than our previous date, which was Tuesday. Let us know what you think.
Two of our biggest annual events are both kicking off this week, the Tribeca Film Festival and NAB. Tribeca starts first. It actually opened last night with Andrew Rossi's documentary First Monday in May about the Met Gala, and it runs until April 24th.
NAB, the film video trade show in Las Vegas, starts April 16th, but the conference part of it starts the 18th on Monday.
So Tribeca is important to us here at No Film School because we're based in New York, but it's really become a major festival. Still, it's pretty New York-centric. As I mentioned, the opening night film was about a big New York event, the Met Gala, and lots of New York filmmakers have their premieres there. This is actually the 15th year of the festival. It was founded by Robert De Niro and Jane Rosenthal to help revitalize downtown New York City after 9/11.
This is actually the first year that the U.S. and the international narrative films are split into two competition categories, similar to what you might see at Sundance, which I would speculate is because Tribeca has been traditionally known for world cinema and for great documentaries, maybe a little bit less so in the American narrative category. Speaking of American narrative films, the opening narrative film is Justin Tipping's Kicks, an ode to hip-hop and sneaker culture, two things that are quintessentially American.
There's 102 features overall in the festival this year and 74 shorts. And I think particularly of note to our crowd, the indie film crowd, is that 42 of those films are from first-time feature directors. We're going to be doing lots of coverage of the festival. I'm actually really excited. I already interviewed the maker of one of my favorite films at this year's festival, Andrew Kahn of Night School. So that interview is going to be going up this week. Night School is another very quintessentially American documentary, not narrative, about folks trying to get through their high school experience in adulthood in Indianapolis, Indiana. And it's really a character portrait, but it points to much larger issues about race relations and economic issues in the U.S.
And speaking of economic issues in the U.S., if you are also a fan of basketball like I am, check out Andrew Kahn's first film that he directed with Davey Rothbart, Medora, about a basketball team that was particularly bereft of wins, but it's very much a film about small-town America and economics. Another film that we will be bringing to you here on this podcast is the DIY genre film Here Alone. Basically, it's the story of a post-apocalyptic viral outbreak, and director Rod Blackhurst and producer Noah Lang joined us on the podcast to talk about making a film that has action and zombies and visual effects, even if you can't tell the visual effects, on a DIY scale.
Yeah, that podcast will be going up next week, and those guys were also kind enough to actually write an article for us that's already up on the site about the preparation they had to do to get their film ready for the festival. This is their first festival and their world premiere, and they learned so much about the kind of essential steps you have to take and all the crazy paperwork and things you just never would necessarily think of that you have to sort of do to get your film ready for these festivals. So yeah, we'll be covering the festival for the next 2 weeks with lots of filmmaker and DP interviews and also some special events like their Storyscapes and virtual arcade, which showcases a lot of new forms of filmmaking like VR. And they do a really interesting programming job there, and it sort of grows every year. So I'm especially looking forward to that portion.
Speaking of VR, I'm sure there's going to be a lot of virtual reality devices and cameras and editing solutions at NAB, the Film Video Trade Show, which used to happen in the week before Tribeca. So here at No Film School, as one of the few sites that covers both the craft of filmmaking as well as the technology, we could sort of go from one to the next. This year, NAB has moved a week later, kicking off the conference part of it April 18th. So the two events, Tribeca and NAB, overlap now. The only way that we can cover it at No Film School adequately is to divide and conquer. So we will all be here in Tribeca until Sunday, when John Fusco and I will be flying to Las Vegas to join Micah Van Hove and a full crew of shooters and editors. And we will bring you everything that's happening there as quickly as we can. If you're in Vegas, stop by and say hi to us. And if you're not making it, hopefully you won't miss anything, because we'll be covering it for you. So stay tuned to nofilmschool.com and to our YouTube channel, where we will be posting coverage sponsored by Blackmagic Design, Shutterstock, and Rode Microphones.
So we're gearing up for those big events, but there is a lot more happening in the indie film world. We actually have an update from last week. We reported that several film companies threatened to pull production from North Carolina in protest of the passage of a recent law that was felt to be anti-LGBT. And those film companies have since been joined by several tech companies, and actually Bruce Springsteen himself, speaking of quintessentially American, who actually canceled his Greensboro, North Carolina show last week in protest of the law. And so finally, the North Carolina Governor McCrory has issued an executive order to expand government equal employment policies to include sexual orientation and gender, which were not included in the original law. So he didn't overturn the law, but he expanded what the law covers. Unfortunately, he didn't expand it all the way. He actually reinforced the portion of the law that says that transgender people must use the bathroom that correlates with the gender on their birth certificates. So we'll see what happens. Your move, film companies.
They were able to get real change enacted in Georgia, and this seems like sort of a halfway measure. Hopefully, the film companies making movies in North Carolina and benefiting the economy there can take a stronger stance and get this half measure into a full one.
A couple of the reporters from the new data website Polygraph undertook the largest analysis of film dialogue ever. These two took over 4 million lines of dialogue and 2,000 scripts. So when they say largest analysis, I think they're probably right. And basically, they analyzed who was speaking when. And what they found is not really a shock. The number of men in speaking roles far, far outweighs the number of women. Actresses had the most amount of dialogue, meaning that they were the lead in only 22% of the 2,000 scripts. Women are more likely to be in second place for the most amount of dialogue in a given film. So in other words, they're more likely than men to be sort of the second lead. But if there are three lead characters, women occupying at least two of those roles is only in 18% of the films. And so it's 82% for men, meaning if there are three leads in a film, there's an 82% chance that two of them are dudes. In a sort of funny subset, the film looked at Disney films as kind of a specific group, because another study last year revealed that even the, quote, princess films were dominated by men. This was the line from the study that really stood out to me. Even in films with female leads like Mulan, the dialogue swings male. Mushu, her protector dragon, has 50% more lines than Mulan herself. The analysts who conducted the study basically said they didn't have a hypothesis going in. They weren't trying to prove that there were more men than women in films. They just wanted to add real data to this ongoing discussion that we've brought up here on the show, too, about gender disparity in Hollywood. And boy, that data really backed up the going belief, which is that, you know, women are not fairly represented. On the website Polygraph, there's a really cool interactive graph where you can kind of change the data inputs and see how these numbers change. Like, you can pick, you know, just horror films and see who has the most or least dialogue. But the overall findings stand throughout all types.
And in that study, is that just male-female? Was there a racial part of the study in terms of the filters you can use and the sliders?
This particular one was just about gender and age.
Well, I have to say, as an Asian American working in film, I had an interesting conversation last night with Alex Wu, who has worked with the A3 Foundation. The A3 Foundation's mission is to foster and support Asian American artists in American media. And they are actually the sponsors of the Asian American Fellowship at Sundance, of which I was the first recipient. So Alex let me know of a pending study that was examining the on-camera and off-camera names on films to see which of those people in all of these roles were Asian. I'll be interested to see how that percentage compares, because if you look at recent award shows like the Oscars, for 60% of the world's population, really you're not seeing a lot of Asians on screen. And I think in the industry, obviously, it's much more than male-female. It's racial. And, you know, hopefully there are a lot of organizations working to do to raise awareness, like Polygraph, or to be able to change the makeup of the industry, like the A3 Foundation, which I should just mention, their portion of the Sundance Labs Fellowship, which we'll talk about in a bit, is open for applications from Asian Americans working in the media. So you can check that out at sundance.org. There's an application there, and the deadline is May 3rd.
The Webby Award nominees were announced last week, and this is relevant to us because the Webbys were really one of the first platforms to recognize that online video was a viable, real, interesting source of entertainment and of value, frankly. So now the Webbys are 20 years old, and the kind of online film and video category is one of their most robust. There's like over 50 video-related awards, including animation, documentary, VR, best editing, best writing, best series, etc. And it's a really fun and crazy time suck to basically explore the nominees.
Yeah, I don't know how many categories there were when I won a Webby, but it was actually the second year when myself and my co-director, Zach Lieberman, won the Webby Award for Best Drama Series in 2008. For our web series, The West Side, which was an urban Western that we very DIY'd ourselves in terms of shooting, editing, posting, releasing, doing that all ourselves. That was actually the second year there was a Webby for any online film video. So they've come a long way. There's lots of categories. It's a great way to sort of see some of the best online video from the past year. But of course, the online voting portion of it is the People's Choice Awards. So that's kind of like a popularity contest, you know, like a presidential election, but they also have a jury. So in our case, we were up against a show at the time called Lonely Girl 15, which had 150 million views, and we managed to win because of the jury. So it's not just online votes. There's also, you know, qualified people choosing, and therefore you sort of get the best of both worlds.
Well, if you want to join the plebs and spend hours going down the rabbit hole of looking at some of the best online videos and voting, you can do that until next Thursday at webbyawards.com. And speaking of online video, Vimeo is starting this weekend to screen short films as movie previews in indie theaters around the country. As if we needed another reason to go to movie theaters, I'm still pretty excited. The move is a partnership with the movie theater advertising company Spotlight Cinema Networks, which is actually owned by Mark Cuban, and they broadcast ads specifically in upscale indie film venues, I think 200 of them. So in the 20-minute preview period before films are scheduled to start playing, they're now going to be showing 1 to 3 Vimeo videos, which are mostly coming from Vimeo staff picks.
That's exciting. It's a great idea. And in general, I'm a fan of Vimeo taking their experience and their curation offline. We have a post at No Film School about a screening they did at South by Southwest, where they screened a number of shorts and then re-ran them without sound with a live director's commentary. Our writer, Micah Van Hove, wrote a post about that to move that experience online. So you can go to No Film School. We'll have a link in the show notes and watch these shorts and then read the director's commentary right there in the post.
Yeah, the fact that Vimeo is trying to do even more with their staff picks, like live events and now theatrical events, is really even more of a reason to put your stuff up there and promote the hell out of it to get it noticed by the staff who makes the picks.
I mean, if there's one lesson I've learned in my career, it's putting yourself out there can have great rewards. Great things can come out of it. And I'm a big fan of Vimeo staff picks because it's not applying for one specific festival. It's you are trying to get attention for your work. And they have a team of people whose entire job it is to bring more attention to your work. One of the things I think that's good to know about is there are triggers to potentially getting your work in front of the Vimeo staff and getting picked up by websites like No Film School or any other blog that's going to feature your work and drive views can help bring that attention to your video to potentially get a staff pick. So that's one thing to keep in mind. So this week on Indie Film Weekly, we're going to debut a new section called Ask No Film School. I think you'll hear on a lot of other podcasts out there, when they're doing sort of a Q&A, it's usually questions culled from Twitter or email. But on No Film School, we have an entire community section of the website. You can register your profile, you can communicate with other filmmakers, you can post questions and get involved in discussions. So we've looked through those boards for a couple of questions to choose to talk about on this week's podcast. And we actually started a thread as well asking for specific questions. So you can find a link to that thread in the show notes. And for every week, we'll be going through the board. So if you have a question on there, you might also find it on the podcast.
One of my favorite questions from this week comes from Alizar Klilu. And Alizar, I am so sorry if I just butchered your name. I think we might have to add a function in the post where you put in your pronunciation. But anyway, Alizar, in a nutshell, asked us, how does he know if his passion for filmmaking is just a phase or if it's worthy of a career? And reading his very articulate post, I pulled this quote. He said, as a 17-year-old beginner filmmaker, I often feel discouraged when people tell me that I'll never find a real job in directing. He goes on to say that he saved up money from a summer job to buy a camera, and he loves studying and making films, but he's about to enter college as a business major, and he's afraid of not being able to make a living in filmmaking. So I have to respond and say, first of all, I love the question. I love that you were even bold enough to ask it. I think, you know, in some ways the fears are legitimate. It is a difficult industry to make a living in. But on the other hand, I think the uncertainty of our field is much less scary than the idea of spending the next 50 years doing something that you don't love or that makes you unhappy. That being said, of course, going to school in general is helpful. You know, we're no film school. None of us here went to film school, and we all studied other things that I think ultimately, you know, inform and help our careers. And I think, you know, I wouldn't shy away from taking business classes. You don't necessarily have to be a business major, but there's a lot of business acumen required for independent filmmaking and a lot of that kind of moxie. And if you have the head for it, it could make you a really excellent producer or a line producer.
Yeah, I mean, that which makes you different can really be a strength. But one thing that indies will find is that business acumen doesn't actually become necessary until you have revenue. For myself, I had to teach myself QuickBooks and learn how to say EBITDA. Is that how you say it? Earnings before interest, taxes, depreciation, and amortization. I didn't have to learn that stuff until that first letter, earnings, is even a case. So if you can develop your creative voice and really know what is unique about yourself, you know, I think that's going to be the main thing that will show the people who doubted you that they were wrong. You know, every filmmaker that you can think of today was doubted at the beginning.
These two included.
For sure. And then I would just say that from there, finding a job in directing, it's very hard to start from a directing position. If you can find work in the industry and network with other people, whether that's as a production assistant, camera assistant, intern, editor, post supervisor, whatever you're going to do where you're around other filmmakers and you're working and you're showing you're trustworthy and that people will find you indispensable, that will bring opportunities your way. And eventually you'll be able to make your own creative projects.
Yeah, so good luck, Alizar. Keep us posted.
Another question was from Kyle Kawiku Harris. Again, disclaimers apply if I'm mispronouncing that. This is the written medium, so we don't have a pronunciation guide. Kyle's question is, what is the most efficient way of finding a good UPM/LP or unit production manager or line producer to help put together package proposals to take to investors?
So Kyle specifically asked for the most efficient way. And, you know, I think like most things in filmmaking, it's not necessarily efficient. You have to really like put your kind of legwork in. What I would say in general is networking seems to be the key way that I've both hired collaborators and gotten hired. So by getting out there and meeting people, either meeting these types directly or asking other director colleagues who they've used and who they like. So if you join groups like IFP or DGA, the Directors Guild, that's a great place to start. If you don't live in a place where you can get to these industry networking events, there's plenty of places to network online, like the No Film School boards, for example, or Facebook groups of filmmakers in your region. So I think you know, actually make, you know, building relationships is the best place to start in terms of getting recommendations.
Yeah, I would say to try to find some films that you admire that either shot in your area or shot in the budget level you're looking to work at. And then identify some members on the crew that you might be able to reach out to. Don't be pushy. Don't immediately ask them to work on your film because anyone in this industry knows the last thing they want is to get asked to do more free work. But if you're personable and you're passionate about something, you know, you'll get a response from somebody, even if it's just to introduce you to somebody who was more junior to them on that film. Everybody knows the hardworking person on that set that was ready to make the leap and that is hungry to prove themselves in a new role. And if you get an intro to that person, I think that's a great way of meeting somebody who's maybe able to do a breakdown of a budget to help you there. However, I would also say that it sounds like what you might be looking for is actually a full producer, not a unit production manager or a line producer. Yeah, because those people are usually coming on when you're going into production, when you have a lot of elements in place and you're already taking a budget and an amount of raised financing and getting more granular and reviewing it and trying to get the details right. If you don't have any idea about what the overall budget is, you may need somebody who has more of a creative and financial role to help you to get to that stage. And for finding that person, I would look to organizations that specifically help introduce filmmakers to people in the industry. And there are a lot of them. I would mention a few like IFP, Film Independent, the Tribeca Film Institute, Sundance Institute, San Francisco Film Society. I've been through those programs and you meet so many people in a very short period of time that if efficiency is what you're interested in, you will certainly meet a lot of producers if you're able to get the attention of one of these organizations.
Yeah, we actually talked about it on last week's show, but the applications to get your film into the IFP Independent Film Week are next month. So that's a great place to start.
IFP.org. And you don't have to be from New York.
We got another question on our boards that I thought was really interesting. I'm going to throw it to Ryan because he's the captain of our DSLR team. But the question is, have I reached the limits of my DSLR? When do you need to upgrade to a cinema quality camera?
Yeah, it's a great question. I had a DSLR. I wrote the DSLR cinematography guide, and then I upgraded to a cinema quality camera. We actually just released a podcast on a decade of DSLRs. So we talked about sort of the evolution and when these cameras came out and what their purpose was in terms of the evolving narrative around digital cinematography. And one of the guests on that podcast is Bryce Fortner, who is the director of photography of the TV show Portlandia. Now, Bryce shot the first season on DSLRs, and it was a three-camera, very minimal crew setup on a very low budget. But as the show got picked up for future seasons and they were able to have a larger budget because they had proved they could find an audience, they moved up to the Canon C series cameras. So that was instructive to me. He did it with whatever they had, and then their work and the attention they garnered allowed them to move up to the quote cinema quality camera. If they hadn't used that lesser equipment that they already had on hand, then their work wouldn't have allowed them to move up to that. So it's sort of like the saying, the best camera is the one that you have. And if you've built an audience and you're getting attention because of it, then that's the time to say, hey, we're ready to make the jump. But I think a lot of people start thinking about, oh, I need the cinema quality camera to get that initial attention. No. Put the creativity and the work first and then upgrade when that's necessary, or when you have the finances as a result, or when you have the audience as a result.
That's right. The camera's always the tool. You know, in the end, it comes down to you and your vision. As we all know, we've mentioned several times on this show, the film Tangerine, which was shot entirely on iPhones and got tons of acclaim. So it starts with you. So we're really excited about this Ask No Film School segment of the show, and we hope you guys like it too. You can submit questions via our community boards at nofilmschool.com or on our Facebook page, and we'll be looking out for them every week.
On to some filmmaking gear-related news. There's one big story this week that everyone's talking about. That is the Lytro Cinema Camera. If you're not familiar with what light field photography is, it's been around. Lytro was actually a consumer company that released a low-resolution, consumer, small version of this just for still images. But in the cinematography world, they have now pivoted to be a professional cinema camera company. And light field photography lets you turn a live video image essentially into a virtual one. it gives you the ability to focus anywhere in a scene, to move the camera left, right, in, out, to adjust the depth of field, to change the exposure, all after the fact, after you've shot the image in post. That is a sea change for how cinematography factors into overall film production and potentially virtual reality, games, certainly has huge implications for visual effects. To do this, there is a ton of data the camera is recording. It is apparently 744 raw megapixels at up to 300 frames per second with 16 stops of dynamic range. But I don't even think that data is the instructive thing, because every pixel is not how we think about it right now. It has depth information, it has color information. If you look at the video on our post at nofilmschool.com about it, you can see it's like LiDAR. It's more like the raw data out of Microsoft Kinect in conjunction with full quality video. So we encourage you to check out that post and see it in action, because it's a little bit hard to explain on an audio podcast. But one way to think about it is that almost every shot can become a green screen shot, because you can separate the elements, and that makes visual effects entirely different.
Yeah, as Ryan mentioned, a lot of folks have been talking about this, especially right on our own post and our Facebook page. It's been the subject of very lively debate from DPs and beyond. I mean, one thing we can say is that with a $125,000 subscription rate, this camera is definitely not for indies right now. But the question is whether this is going to become a standard in the film industry and beyond. Right now, it's a no-brainer for virtual reality and video game material and VFX-heavy films. But, if this technology comes down in cost, just like every other technology has, it could be a real game changer across the board, which, by the way, is pissing off a lot of DPs in our community.
Well, yeah. I mean, traditionally, all of the choices that you make during production show your intent as a storyteller. And when you give people the ability to change all of those things in post, of course, your intent could be lost or changed. Famously, filmmakers like Hitchcock would not shoot very much coverage and would not shoot different lenses and frame sizes because they didn't want their movie to be ruined in the edit by the studio. In this case, the studio could change literally almost everything that you did other than the actor's performances. And of course, that's a separate technology to use to change that. What I'm curious about with the Lytro is the post-production part of it. Obviously, you're not just going to be able to open these files on USB 3 hard drives on your laptop in Premiere Pro or Final Cut. So I'm curious about that $125,000 subscription price. What does that mean? What are the tools that you need? What are the data storage needs? Stay tuned. We'll be tracking this story for a very long time, because this could change the film industry at No Film School. A couple of other seemingly minor announcements compared to the Lytro camera are that Canon and Sony have both announced some new compact large sensor camcorders. These are like sort of drone cameras, crash cams, B cams. They are smaller versions of cameras that Canon and Sony already have. I have to question some of the nomenclature about these things. I feel like engineers name these cameras and then they don't come up with other names for it and they just release it. So the new Canon camera is called the ME200S-SH, which just rolls right off the tongue.
But
the S-ish. It has similar specs to the Canon C100 Mark II, but it's in a much smaller cube form factor. So we'll be keeping track of that. It doesn't have any internal recording. It doesn't have a display. So in some ways, you know, we're always going forward with cameras that have more features, and then they're stripping them out to make something smaller and lighter weight. On the Sony side, also rolls right off the tongue, the UMC-S3C, which does have internal recording to an SD card. It's kind of like a small A7S II. It's got a full frame 35mm 4K sensor, but it's even smaller. So these are cameras that are interesting when you're trying to get into tight spaces. You're trying to put a camera on a drone and you're looking for a higher quality image. We'll keep track of those things as they are hitting the market, because right now these are both just announcements.
And again, by the way, the first of a slew of announcements that are sure to come at NAB later in the week. We already spoke about on the show the release of the new 7-inch HDR monitors, the Atomos Shogun Flames. We realized that the HDR technology was a little bit confusing to some of our readers, so we're actually putting up a post today that kind of breaks down the benefits of HDR in layman's terms and what it will actually mean for shooting. And in an exclusive post that went up yesterday, we talked about the Quantify app. This is kind of an exciting new app. It was created by two documentary filmmakers while they were making a film about apps. It was just released in the Apple Store yesterday. And basically, the app came about because of an issue that these filmmakers were having and that so many of us have when we're out there shooting tons of footage, which is that they were shooting tons of footage and they could never quite remember where their golden moments were and kept having to go back and spend hours reviewing the footage to find those pieces again. So what the app lets you do is basically discreetly timestamp and kind of rate moments right during a shoot. And then it exports a file that you can seamlessly import into Premiere Pro, and it'll line up with your timeline so you can see basically your best takes already marked when you start the edit. Moving on to our grant and opportunity deadlines for this week. If you're thinking of doing a crowdfunding campaign for your documentary, now is the time, because Project Greenlight Digital Studios and Seed and Spark have teamed up to provide $20,000 to a film who runs a Seed and Spark campaign that starts between May 1st and June 1st and ends by June 30th. Basically, the top 10 campaigns to receive the most audience support during that period will move on to the finals, and then a panel of esteemed documentary filmmakers will choose the film that gets that 20 grand. So you'll sort of get to add benefit to the fact that you're already doing a campaign. If you're an up-and-coming music video director, you can submit a video to Radar's Music Video Awards for some great industry exposure and the chance to win internships and mentorships with cutting-edge studios. They're based in the UK, but they're open to submissions from all over the world, and that deadline is April 17th.
The Bertha BritDoc Connect Fund is a joint initiative between the Bertha Foundation and BritDoc. It's the first European-based fund between 5,000 and 50,000 euros that is open to filmmakers from anywhere with outreach campaigns. Liz, what is an outreach campaign? What does that mean?
Well, that's what's notable about this fund. It's such a huge pile of money, and it's one of the only ones that covers outreach campaigns, which basically means once your film is done, and this is primarily speaking to documentaries or social issue films, once your film is done, if you want to continue to push the issue that you are that you're covering in your film and to sort of activate audiences around it, there's so many ways to do that now with transmedia projects and live events, and this fund will specifically give you money to do that piece of your work, which actually is pretty great because you've already laid out so much money to finish the film and get it out to festivals. And then if you want the film to actually continue to make an impact, you're sort of out of money at that point.
That's a great idea, and I think that's something we'd love to see from more funding organizations.
For sure. So that deadline is April 18th. May 2nd is your deadline for the ITVS Digital Open Call. You all might know ITVS already, the independent television service, which is part of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. They support lots of documentary films, and they're airing on PBS stations. But now this digital open call provides up to 50 grand in R&D funding to develop and pilot digital series and concepts. It's notable because, again, it's R&D funding, so it gives you seed money early on, and it's open to concepts on any subject from any viewpoint, as long as it might have sort of a place on public media's digital platform. So it's not just for docs, it's not just for social issues. It really could be for anything. It's just that the projects have to be in development and cannot have begun principal production.
The Sundance Institute Screenwriters Lab deadline is May 3rd. Of course, that is not this week, but your screenplay is not written in a week. So we're trying to give a little bit more advance notice for this one because it's so well known in the screenwriting community. One of the main opportunities that can break careers. I myself got into the lab and I myself have been rejected from the lab. So get writing. The application is available to US and international filmmakers who are working on their first or second feature. And you can find that at sundance.org. What you typically need for that first application round is the first several pages of your screenplay and several essay format questions. Again, that eventual deadline is May 3rd, but you're probably working on the screenplay itself right now.
Get those screenplays done in the next 2 weeks. Good luck.
Well, actually what happens there a lot is you make all the statements and you apply with the first several pages of the script, which is the initial round. And then there's another round where if you are named a finalist, they will ask you for the full screenplay. So between now and that notification date is when a lot of screenwriters have that extra motivation to write the remaining pages in case they are named a finalist, because otherwise they are not going to have any ability to turn out something of quality. So it's a good motivator, even if you aren't selected.
There's a few notable festival deadlines coming up this week. April 15th is the San Francisco Black Film Festival deadline. This festival's been running 17 years. It celebrates African-American cinema and the African cultural diaspora by showcasing a diverse collection of films from emerging and established filmmakers from the Bay Area and around the world.
Closer to home here in Brooklyn, the Bushwick Film Festival early bird deadline is April 15th. The Bushwick Festival has been around since 2007, and it exhibits independent film right here in New York City. It is eclectic. It's creative. It focuses on contemporary work. Bushwick is also the home of our managing editor, Emily Booter.
Further proving its coolness.
And it has competition awards valued at $4,000.
We like competitions that give money. With the deadline coming up on April 20th is the Immigration Film Festival. It's not necessarily a well-known festival, but we thought it was especially pertinent this year with the Syrian refugee crisis and European refugee issues. And of course, right here in the U.S., Republicans advocating for the wall. The Immigration Film Festival is now in its third year. It's held in Washington, D.C., and unsurprisingly, it showcases films that educate and advocate about justice for immigrants and refugees in the U.S. and around the world. They are a grassroots, volunteer-run organization, and they screen about 20 films of this genre.
The Raindance Film Festival is a big festival in the U.K. The deadline is April 22nd. It is actually the 24th year of the Raindance Festival. Happens right in the heart of London in the West End Film District. And they have screenings, seminars, workshops, panels. It's one of the larger festivals in Europe. It is also an Academy Award and BAFTA qualifying festival.
Links to all of these grant deadlines, opportunities, and festivals are available, as always, on nofilmschool.com/podcasts, where you can see the post associated with this and all of our other podcasts.
And as always, we have some movies opening. I'm hearing really great things about The Invitation. It is out now on video on demand, being released by Alamo Drafthouse. Really looking forward to seeing it, so search for that.
There's a much talked about release coming out Friday on Amazon Prime Instant, Jane Got a Gun.
Now, this is the movie that stars Natalie Portman as a woman who asks her ex-lover for help in order to save her outlaw husband from a murderous gang. It's a Western directed by Gavin O'Connor, who made Warrior, and it also stars Joel Edgerton and Ewan McGregor. One of the reasons it's much talked about, though, is that it was one of the films caught up in the bankruptcy of Relativity Media. It had an original release date pushed and then was acquired by the Weinstein Company. Relativity, for those who don't know, is the infamous movie studio run by Ryan Kavanaugh that claimed to have an algorithm for ensuring financial success, or at least minimizing the financial risk in making movies. In following the Relativity story, the famous William Goldman quote, "Nobody knows anything," always came to mind. And in the case of Relativity going bankrupt and bringing down some films with it, that adage turned out to be true. We have a piece coming on No Film School about the algorithm that Relativity used and analyzing what went wrong. So stay tuned. And in the meantime, check out Jane Got a Gun to see if that algorithm yielded an entertaining film.
Another one coming out on Amazon is The Adderall Diaries. It's the James Franco and Amber Heard film that was a kind of hit at last year's Tribeca. And actually, on a side note, there's a documentary called After Adderall that recently finished production that's by the subject of The Adderall Diaries, Stephen Elliott, about James Franco making a movie about him. So it's pretty meta. I like that there's sort of a film with an accompanying film. So looking forward to checking both of those out.
And that seems to be a trend as well with Christine and Kate Plays Christine, both premiering at Sundance this year. Moving to theatrical releases, Jeremy Saulnier's newest film, Green Room, is coming out from A24. Now, this is a long-awaited, long-hyped follow-up to his first feature, Blue Ruin, which I loved. John Fusco at Sundance very much appreciated this movie. Myself, less so, but I am a fan of Saulnier, and I did very much appreciate Blue Ruin. Anyway, check out Green Room and see whether you agree with John or me.
Finally, this week, Sing Street is being released. It was a Sundance favorite from this year from the writer-director of Once. So if it's anything like Once, it's bound to be lovely.
That's it for Indie Film Weekly this week. Next week, we will be coming to you from New York and Las Vegas in a tag team episode to cover both the Tribeca Film Festival and NAB. As always, please subscribe and rate us in iTunes.
Indie Film Weekly is produced and edited by John Fusco. And please visit us at nofilmschool.com for the podcast links from this show, more podcasts, and tons of articles about making films. See you next week.